international media is full of stories about the great rotation that is once again time to occur, or so they tell us. The Magnificent Seven have had a multi-year outperformance, but are the Magnificent Seven on the New York Stock Exchange coming to the end of their days of outperformance, and are we supposedly now needing to put money elsewhere? Sean Ashton is with Ombe, and he'll be giving us all the answers. Sean, as always, really good to be talking with you. Maybe we can start at the most obvious place, and this Magnificent Seven, those seven stocks, why have they been outperforming by so far for so long?
I think it's largely about earnings at the end of the day. I mean, you have had some pockets of re-rating as well, but the earnings outperformance from this grouping of stocks, by and large, has been spectacular. And that's probably, you know, the poster child for that phenomenon would have been NVIDIA in this cycle, less so the others. But, you know, NVIDIA, many people might not be aware that its forward PE multiple now is around half of what it was at the end of 2021. So it hasn't been a rating thing, it's been an earnings thing. And that's largely a function of the massive CapEx expenditure that we see for a lot of the people that are buying their chips.
Artificial intelligence is really hitting the high points pretty much everywhere. But when we go into a little more detail there, are you buying the story that the Magnificent Seven have had their run and it's time to start looking at smaller cap stocks in the light of the booster that they're going to get from a cut in American interest rates?
I think you always want to be looking across the market for opportunities, Alec. I don't believe that the time in the sun is necessarily done. I think we got to a point where market concentration was at historically high levels. That's been spoken about at length. When we published this article, I think it was something like 43% of the S&P 500's market cap was 15 companies. Okay. Now, one needs to preface the conversation by saying that index concentration is a feature, it's not a bug, and that a lot of select few winners drive most of the market's returns over time. In fact, I saw a recent chart that was shared across social media showing, I think it was published by Baird, with a big asset manager in the US, where since 1926, they showed a chart of the median and mean return of all 29,000 US shares since 1926. And the mean cumulative return was like 23,000%, and the median was minus 7.4. So like the median stock actually hasn't delivered value. It's been like 4% of the holdings that have delivered all the return since the beginning of time, basically. So that's always important to bear in mind. It's not always the same group of shares, and market leadership does shift. But concentration is a feature that we will always have in market cap weighted indices. That's important to realize. Having said that, I think concentration has been historically high recently. You've obviously had this issue of a few companies doing very well. And at extremes, you can have periods of mean reversion and a natural snapback. It's like when you stretch the elastic, you get a bit of a snapback effect. And I think that's what we've had for the better part of the last 2 weeks. And I don't think it's necessarily a function of the companies in the outside of the Mag 7 are your new secular growers. That's not necessarily what I would say. I think that, yes, interest rates coming down will probably benefit them disproportionately relative to your mega cap companies, where those businesses tend to be less levered. They've got cash in their balance sheets. They're not dependent on capital markets for raising debt for argument's sake. And so your smaller companies would benefit more from a cut in rates. But I'm not sure they're necessarily the secular growers. It's just interesting to point out as well, there's another dynamic at play in terms of what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, this big shift towards small and mid-cap shares. And I guess the Russell 2000 as an index is probably the one that's most spoken about right now. You've had about 11% outperformance month to date of the Russell versus the S&P 500. That's quite dramatic. But within that, what's notable as well is that it seems to be a relative positioning story, right? So if you look at the S&P 500, for argument's sake, and you look at what short interest there is for across the whole index. Now, short interest is effectively the proportion of shares that's lent out to hedge funds for those managers in the market to go and sell the shares that they don't own with the hope that they'll buy them back cheaper. So it's almost, if you look at companies that have a high short interest, you would say those are the businesses which are the opposite of the ones that are heavily owned by all the consensus, the consensus positioning, like the Magnificent Seven would probably be the least shorted shares. So for the S&P 500 as a whole, short interest, the average short interest across all these companies is about 2.5%. For the Magnificent Seven, outside of Tesla, it's about less than 1%, right? So much lower than the average. And those are the companies that have underperformed month to date, right? So that's telling you this is like a ship from people moving from one side of the boat to the other side of the boat in quite a hurry to try and reposition portfolios. When you look at the Russell 2000 as an index, it's got double the short interest for the average stock out there, about 5%. And interestingly, the top 20 performing companies month to date, it's about 12% short interest. And the average return of those top 20 companies is like 65% if you look at the month-to-date return. So it looks like you've had quite a big squeeze of hedge fund managers having to buy back shares that they have been short, and that can obviously drive share prices high in quite a short space of time. So I think as much as anything else, this represents a sharp shift in relative positioning, portfolio positioning. It's not suddenly saying that these are the better companies to own on a secular basis, but you can have these snapback periods. And I think that's what we've experienced in the last 2 weeks.
It's so interesting when you unpack it to that degree. It does show you that there are often technical issues that will cause the market to bounce one way or the other. But for investors or amateur investors, for those who are putting their money there and waiting for the long-term benefits to accrue, they can get very confused and, in fact, probably lose a lot of money by trying to interpret technical changes, which are not there for them to really understand unless they've got the inside track like you've got right now. So what does it all mean, though, for somebody who's, say, got a big chunk of their portfolio in the S&P 500 index? Because this is really a very popular investment area, but it's also well known, and in your article that you published last week, it showed how heavy the weighting is towards the big stock companies. I pulled out a few numbers. 12, the S&P 500 companies, 12 companies make up 40% of the total index. So clearly there's a big weighting. So how are you reading that one?
I think it's in line with what we've been saying, that companies that are growing the fastest will tend to concentrate their positioning and generate higher ratings than businesses that don't have secular growth. Doesn't mean it'll always be the same companies, though. So when you take a very long-term view, for somebody who's an owner of the S&P 500, if you're taking a 10 or 20-year view, I wouldn't worry too much, because even if the top stocks that are forming the main concentration of the index today, there will be different shares in 15 to 20 years' time, but new leadership will emerge. And I think what you're seeing right now is potentially a market dislocation where leadership could shift, but we don't know that for sure. It's too early to tell. Over time, market concentration will remain high, not necessarily as high as it is right now, but new leaders will emerge. I think the other important point to make, Alec, is that
I'm listening.
When you look at the exercise we did in this article was to segment the entire S&P 500 into cohorts of companies by the average weighting and the forecast consensus revenue and earnings growth for the next 2 years, and then look at the valuation multiples. Now, whilst it's important to realize that those top companies we talk about are very expensive, I think at the time of writing, your top 10 companies had an average, simple average forward P of like 40 times, which is almost double that of the index. And they accounted for like 38% of the market cap. The forecast average revenue growth was like 17% for the next 2 years, and compound earnings growth was about 28%, right? The next 100 companies below that cohort in terms of number of companies was 37% of the total index. Now, that's 100 companies, 10 times more companies, but obviously a similar weighting. But suddenly your forecast revenue growth and profit growth was less than half what it was for the top 10 companies. And what was very interesting was that as you go down the cohorts, you know, the next 100, the final remaining companies, there was a pretty consistent size versus revenue and profit growth differential. In other words, the smaller the company, the slower they were growing, which is quite interesting to note. You know, you would expect, you know, kind of conventional wisdom would say that, you know, smaller businesses have the potential to grow faster, but that's not what we're seeing today. What we're seeing today is that your larger companies are actually delivering the fastest rate of growth, which could have something to do with you know, change in the structure of the economy, that there's more power laws today. Companies that gain scale find it easier to sustain that scale, and the returns to scale get bigger. I think an example I've used in the past was Meta and Alphabet, where it would be unthinkable for two companies to be 70% of global advertising market share 30 years ago, and today that's true. And they're able to sustain these competitive advantages through through the scale that online businesses affords. So right now we've got the situation where your smallest companies also are the cheapest. It's quite consistent across market cap cohorts. And so if you're owning the S&P 500, or if you're saying you want to trade out of the S&P 500 in favor of either a smaller cap index or even an equally weighted S&P 500, which is a trade that we've made, what you're explicitly doing is you're saying, I want to downweight the size factor and I want to upweight the value factor as opposed to earnings momentum. And the key question that one's got to ask yourself with S&P 500 today as an index is, you know, yes, you could argue that these relative valuations across size cohorts are justified by the current rate of earnings growth being achieved, but for how long will that be achieved beyond the next, say, 2 years? And that's the big question that nobody really knows the answer to.
Very interesting point that you make there about the S&P 500 index, which most people buy, being weighted. So as these gorillas get bigger, they get a bigger weighting in the index. But you can invest, and that was what your story suggested as well, in a equal weighted. In other words, I guess all 500 members of the S&P 500 get the same weighting. So whether you're a Pacific Bio or if you're an Apple, you get exactly the same percentage of the portfolio put into your stock. Just explain why that would even be a trade, or why that would be an option.
Yeah, so effectively what you're saying is you want to downweight earnings momentum and downweight the size factor, and you're saying, I don't want this index concentration. I want the average of all the companies, right? And I'm not suggesting that that's a secularly good trade. I think for points in time in a cycle, it can be a good trade. And as a house view, we've made that trade. I think we've been a bit early on that call so far. But you're effectively saying, I don't want this index concentration risk where I put 7% in Microsoft. I want to have 0.25% in Microsoft. And these are all great companies across. I want to own a broad exposure to America Inc. as opposed to having, you know, 40% of my money tied up in seven companies. That's effectively the logic behind it. But what you're effectively doing is you're down-weighting your winners all the time. But at points in time where you get these market extremes in terms of concentration, that can snap back quite quickly. And you've seen, I think as recently as 2 weeks ago, the equally weighted index had underperformed the cap-weighted index by 11%. That's now only 6%. So you've had this dramatic snapback in the last 2 weeks. So you would have caught up a lot of performance, and it could still have further to go. But it's, you know, that's not, yeah. You know, I wouldn't advocate for a 10-year holding of the equally weighted index over the cap weighted index, because I don't want to be systematically downweighting new companies that always that will come through and become your future winners. And that's effectively what that index will do over time.
Very interesting point you make there. Last night I was reading in a wonderful book, The Essays of Warren Buffett, which I'm sure you know about it. And what's happened there is a guy called Lawrence Cunningham has taken, working with Warren Buffett, has taken all of those annual letters to shareholders in the last 60 years and taken points out of it and then compiled them into themes. And one of the themes he was talking about was selling your winners. In other words, when do you take profits? And Buffett's view on this, which he's explained a few times, is that it's a little bit like when you're buying a portfolio of stocks. It's like if you can imagine buying 20% of the earnings stream of a bunch of basketball players who are while they're still at a young period. And as they grow, some of them are going to go into professional and they're going to make lots of money for you. Others aren't going to do as well. And he said, it would be unthinkable to sell your best basketball players when they are generating the most profit for you in that case. And he was saying a similar thing when it comes to stocks. Not all of them are going to be outperformers, but the outperformers, be wary of selling them, because those are the ones who have proved that they really do make a difference to your portfolio. Your thought on that?
I absolutely agree with that. I think your best stocks contribute disproportionately to your performance, and you need to think very long and hard about cutting them. And I think the risk that most investors and professional portfolio managers, probably the mistake they make, is cutting their winners too soon and adding to their losers. It's such a simple rule, but that tends to be the mistake that most people make, rather than courting the next turn in some obscure cycle. And it's a very simple rule. But your winners earn a bigger place in your portfolio for a reason. And the reason is generally that they're outperforming. That they're operationally outperforming. I think the challenge that we've got right now, where this cycle is quite interesting, is that if you look at something like Nvidia, which is now 6 or 7% of the S&P 500, it has been the leading stock and the poster child for this cycle. It's gone from a much smaller weighting, I don't know, 1 or 2% to 6 or 7% of the index. It hasn't been a valuation thing. This is the important thing to say. The earnings multiple has gone from circa 70 times forward 3 years ago to about 35 or 38 times now. It's actually derated in the last 3 years. Okay, so this has been an earnings story. But the question that we've now got to answer, and again, no one knows the answer to this, and we're all trying to work it out, you try to predict the future, which is inherently unknowable, is you've now got a situation where this is a business that was making $8 billion of turnover 2 years ago. Now $26 billion a quarter, right? These are quarterly numbers. So it's more than doubled over a two-year time frame. And your margins have gone from 30% to 65%. Operating margins, not gross margins. So we haven't seen a business at this scale generating these types of margins, I think, ever. And the concern now for most investors, and certainly for us, is not so much what the multiple is that's being attached to this business, but the underlying sustainability of the earnings cycle, because semiconductors are cyclical, we know that. And for a business like Nvidia, they it's not really the end consumer that they're selling to. It's not like the chips by and large are going into laptops that are being sold to consumers. And that's actually a market that's been in quite a tough space for a while. Rather, their chips are being sold to data centers around the world that are owned by Meta, Alphabet, Amazon, you would argue, to a large extent, Microsoft. And these companies have ramped up their CapEx budgets significantly in the last 12 months. And the most recent report was obviously Alphabet, where I think they've gone from, say, $6 billion of quarterly CapEx to $13 billion now. And they're guiding it to be $12 billion plus in the coming quarters. And what's happening now is we're in this new industrial revolution of AI driving a lot of efficiency in businesses and potentially new business models. But we've reached the point in the cycle where analysts are starting to ask the good questions and the right questions around, okay, you're spending all this money, but where's the payoff now? And where are the new business models? Where's the return on investment? Can you delineate for us where your customers are either saving money or being able to generate new revenues? And certainly, I think the volatility that we saw last week around Alphabet's results was indicative of management not being able to provide very good answers to those questions because they probably don't know. And it's much like what, you know, what the internet was like when it launched in the early 90s. Nobody knew how it would evolve, but it evolved into a massive new economy, basically. You know, it created new industries, new jobs, but no one could forecast that ahead of time. And we're in that awkward phase now where the CapEx budgets have ramped up, investment is taking place, and companies that are making these investments are not yet able to say to you, we know that this is the future, but they're not yet able to say very clearly, you know, we'll cite examples of where the returns are coming from, because it's still too early, I would argue. And so we don't know how long this investment cycle is, but what we do know is that NVIDIA's business model is reliant on other people's CapEx. And other people's CapEx is a cyclical number. You can have booms and you can have busts. And if we go into a down cycle from an elevated earnings point of view, you know, the earnings base becomes the risk for NVIDIA, and then 40 PE can quickly derate, you know, to a 20 PE if there's an anticipation of a slowdown. And so I think that's the risk we face right now, is very high earnings base is reliant on a multi-year investment cycle being sustained and even growing off this base. And we don't know how long it will last for. But yeah, the questions are being asked and the answers are not clear yet.
Fascinating insights from Sean Ashton of Omber. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.